actually funny because in college I was supposed to major in pottery, but the pottery class was at 11 in the morning. And I said, speak to the hand to that class, because I'm not getting up at 11 in the morning.
It's my Werner Herzog impression, I guess. If anybody has ever heard of the German film director Werner Herzog, that's my topical impression of him. Welcome
to A Slice of Ham. For you see, this is the podcast where many things are talked about.
I like Werner Herzog's movies. If you've seen Grizzly Man, it's a great film. Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans. Great film. Hi. I forgot to say hi to everyone. That was a really convoluted intro. Welcome to A Slice of Ham. Welcome to another episode of the Monday Night Book Club. Oh my God. The response to this book, the response to me reading this book as well, it seems to be a mix of like, yeah, keep reading it, and also don't keep reading it. But the people that are saying don't keep reading it are also the people that are saying keep reading it. So I fully understand because I'm right there with you. So I figured we might be able to get through a substantial portion of this book today. We've gotten through part one entirely. So part one of The Family Next Door, if you haven't already heard, if you haven't been here, if you've lived under a rock, we've been reading The Family Next Door, the heartbreaking imprisonment of the 13 Turpin siblings and their extraordinary rescue by the wonderful John Glatt. I love that name. If you haven't been with us, we have been reading The Family Next Door, and so far we've gotten through the prologue, we've gotten through chapters 1, 2, 3, and 4. Yeah, we've gotten through, like, part 1 of the book. Part 1 was The Seeds of Evil, and now we're ready to get into part 2 of the book, which has a much more sinister title to me if you know what the Turpin case is about. Part 2 is entitled The Family. So I have a feeling that we're going to get a good look into the family life of the Turpins, specifically David and Louise. We've already gotten into David and Louise's childhoods, how they grew up, how they essentially learned how to abuse, how they picked their behaviors to, you know, take with them throughout their life, their habits, their bad habits, their good habits, how they learned to become abusers. And now we get to see what they learned put into action. So I'm actually very intrigued to see what exactly happens. I'm intrigued in a very morbid way, in a way that, like, you can't look away from a car crash. Part of me actually wonders, why are we so fascinated with stuff like this? Or why am I so fascinated with stuff like this? I can't really speak for anyone else. But I don't know. I'm very interested in psychology, so I'm interested in the psychological aspect of it. But I also think that it, like, going over true crime cases, as morbid as they can be, it makes me glad to be alive. And it also makes me appreciate the people that I have around me, my friends, my family, because they could be gone at any moment. We all could be gone at any moment. So you really have to live each day as if it were your last. Not recklessly, but appreciatively. Man, trigger warning, of course, there's going to be some nasty shit in this book. The Turpins are disgusting. There's going to be probably themed. I haven't read the book. I'm reading it for the first time as you guys are. So I'm giving my reactions as I read. There are absolutely going to be themes of child abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse, neglect, manipulation, gaslighting. I would just say, trigger warning, brace yourself. I don't even know what I'm in for. I don't even know if any of this stuff is going to trigger me. So we're going to go on this ride together if you so choose. But I want to give the message right here at the beginning. If this is something that you think is too heavy, or if while you're hearing this you start to feel a little uneasy, turn it off. Go listen to a palate cleanser. It'll be all right. The episode that I just released on, not Thursday, but Friday, the mental health episode. That's a pretty great episode. That's a pretty good insight into me, and it does not cover anything gruesome. So if you want to still hear my voice, but if you don't want to hear any gruesome stuff, you can turn that on. Or if you don't want to hear my voice at all, turn on something else. No hard feelings. You got to look out for you.
Without further ado,
let's get into the adventures of the bowl cut bastard and the queen of farts, the swamp witch bitch, David and Louise Turpin. Yeah. Listen, I don't think these two people are very good. And I'm just going to say it on the record. I'm going to say that on the record. I don't think these people are very good. Chapter 5. I thought their life was perfect. In the fall of 1987, Louise Turpin became pregnant. She and David were delighted. Louise had always told her family that she wanted a dozen children, and now she was on her way. The following summer, David photographed his 20-year-old wife wearing a checkered shirt and proudly displaying her 8-month pregnant belly. She sent the photograph back home to Princeton, where her proud father duly wrote, "Louise Ann Robinette Turp, July 1988, at the bottom. A few days later, on July 28th, Louise gave birth to a little girl, whom they named Jennifer Dawn. Over the next few weeks, Louise would send a stream of photos of herself and David posing with their baby daughter at Disneyland and other scenic places in Southern California. That Christmas, true to her word, Louise paid for her mother and siblings to come to California and meet her new baby. They took the Amtrak train from Princeton to Brea, where David and Louise met them at the station. "It was so cool," remembered Teresa, who was 6 at the time. "She took us to her house. It was very clean and well-kept." For the next 3 weeks, the Robinettes stayed with the Turpins, going on lavish day trips to Disneyland, Universal Studios, and the Movie Land Wax Museum. "We saw the Hollywood sign," said Teresa, "and the world's biggest tree with a tunnel cut through it. It was a trip I will never forget." In early 1990, David Turpin was transferred back to Fort Worth by General Dynamics, soon to be taken over by the huge defense contractor Lockheed Martin. He moved Louise and their now 18-month-old daughter into 3225 Roddy Drive, a spacious, modern, 4-bedroom, 2-bathroom house in the fashionable Meadow Creek neighborhood on the outskirts of Fort Worth. They left a storage unit full of their belongings back in California, which was later auctioned off for non-payment. Finally, Louise and David were ready to introduce their little daughter Jennifer to Princeton, West Virginia. On August 6th, 1990, the Bluefield Daily Telegraph featured a birthday picture of the Turpin toddler on the Lifestyle's Keeping in Touch page. David Turpin was now earning a 6-figure salary in his highly specialized engineering job, and soon after moving in, Louise invited her mother and siblings to visit. It was the start of a series of much-anticipated annual trips that the Robinette family would make to Texas over the next decade, with Louise and David paying for everything. "She was paying for our airfare out there every year," said Teresa. "My mom couldn't afford that." And when they arrived, David and Louise were more than generous hosts, taking them all out to Fort Worth Stockyards and Six Flags over Texas and dining at the best restaurants. "It was the highlight of our year," said Teresa, "because that's when we got to do the fun things." But she never really got to know her brother-in-law, David, who always seemed very distant during the visits. "He was very quiet," remembered Teresa. "He always sat back and watched and observed. He was very, very smart. Book smart. The nerdy type."
The nerdy type.
Back in Princeton, Alan Robinette had given up preaching and had been elected Mercer County Surveyor, running his own office in the Mercer County Courthouse on Main Street. He was very active in the West Virginia Democratic Party. "Everybody liked Alan," said his friend Verlin Moy, a Mercer County clerk. "He did a lot of complex tax formula work." I need to give a better voice to Verlin Moy. Okay, here's what Verlin Moy sounds like.
"Everybody liked Alan. He did a lot of complex tax formula work with land tables and that kind of thing. He specialized in the appraisal end of the assessor's office.
Thanks, Verlin. What was his parents thinking? Robinette would proudly talk about his son-in-law, David, saying he was making big money for a defense contractor. But he never mentioned how his daughter, Louise, had run away at 16 to elope, leading to his bitter divorce.
I just really didn't know they had a falling out over that, said Moy. Alan just never did divulge any of his personal life to me.
Still deeply religious and active in the Princeton Church of God, Alan started every county commission meeting with a prayer. When he wasn't busy assessing taxes, he collected celebrity autographs and NASCAR memorabilia. His prize collection included every American astronaut and many U.S. presidents and world figures. A few years later, the Bluefield Daily Telegraph would run a story about Alan Robinette's impressive collection of celebrity autographs. With the headline, "True Collectors Never Know When to Say When," there was a picture of Louise's father in which he wore a checkered shirt and overalls, standing by his collection. In the article, Robinette boasted that he now had more than 3,000 autographs in his collection, including almost every American astronaut. He said his first ever autograph had been Republican presidential candidate Barry Goldwater, who lost to Lyndon Johnson in 1964. "I was a student in high school and a Goldwater admirer," explained Robinette. "I wrote him, and he replied. That is how I started collecting." With prized autographs of every president from John F. Kennedy to George Bush, Robinette had strong views about anyone trying to profit from selling famous people's autographs. "He had an extensive, impressive collection," recalled Moy. "Oh,
he had an extensive, impressive collection," recalled Moy. "Mother Teresa, Gandhi, and Princess Diana, just anybody and everybody. It was amazing to me."
But while Alan Robinette held one of the most important jobs in Mercer County, his ex-wife and two youngest daughters were now destitute and living in a homeless shelter in Tennessee. On February 3rd, 1992, Louise Turpin gave birth to a baby boy. His name was Joshua David. From then on, all their babies' Christian names would begin with the letter J. Soon after Joshua was born, David and Louise Turpin filed Chapter 7 bankruptcy. Despite David's high salary, the couple had been living beyond their means and had maxed out their credit cards, racking up substantial debt. Louise had also recently discovered a passion for gambling and had been losing heavily. But she never admitted any financial problems to her family, always pretending that everything was fine. And during her family's annual visit, Louise was as generous as ever. "It was a pride thing," explained Teresa. "She was the only one of us that had made it in the world. I believe she was ashamed to tell us anything bad happened." Chapter 6. Meadow Creek Elementary School. In July 1993, Louise met her family at Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport, heavily pregnant with her third child. Once again, Louise insisted on paying for everything. Being homeless, Phyllis and her daughters were delighted to be staying in Louise and David's house on Roddy Drive. "That house was beautiful," said Teresa. "It was fun and happy." On November 3rd, Louise gave birth to a baby girl named Jessica Louise at Texas Health Harris Methodist Hospital, South Fort Worth. Jesus Christ. Texas Health Harris Methodist Hospital, Southwest Fort Worth. Who gives a shit? There was a brief mention in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram that the new baby's parents were Louise Ann and David Allen Turpin of Fort Worth. In the spring of 1994, the Telegram invited readers to send in some of their favorite family photographs, accompanied by a short sentence about their mother. for an upcoming feature to celebrate Mother's Day. David and Louise Turpin entered a number of photographs, resulting in three appearing in the newspaper. In one photograph, Louise is pictured with Jennifer, Joshua, and baby Jessica in their backyard, playing with their pet dog, Blackie. In another, David and Louise pose with Jennifer as a baby, along with her paternal grandmother, Betty Turpin. "My mother is very special and we love her very much," read David's caption below. The third, which was around 5 years old, showed Phyllis Robinette holding her newly born son, Billy Jr. Next to them stood David with Louise holding Jennifer. "There is no other like my mother," read Louise's caption. "She's the best." 15 months later, 8-year-old Jennifer Turpin started first grade at Meadow Creek Elementary School, just a few blocks from her home on Roddy Drive. Every morning, Louise would drive her to school and then collect her in the afternoon. From the start, the frail-looking girl was cruelly taunted by her peers. Not only was she a couple of years older than everybody else in her class, but she had poor personal hygiene. She wore the same white and purple fluffy top to school each day, and her long, greasy brown hair, crudely cut into bangs, was never brushed. She was also missing her two front teeth, as her adult ones had not come in yet. "She was definitely criticized," recalled Jared Dana, who was in Jennifer's class. "She used to wear the same smelly shoes every day, a pair of beaten overalls and a purple shirt. A lot of the time she'd take foil out of our candy bars to do up her hair. Her classmates would hold their nose when she passed by." Dana, who was also bullied, was one of the few kids who would talk to her. "I was a pretty shy kid as well," he recalled. "I wouldn't say we were drawn toward each other, but we talked on occasion. Jennifer was genuinely nice. I don't think she ever had a mean bone in her body. On a dare, I once kissed her on the cheek, and I was ridiculed horribly for it." He still remembers the little Turpin girl as being unusually hyperactive and excitable. "She was very full of energy at school. On field days, she was always super excited and would be the first one running in front of everybody." Aaron Pankritz was also in Jennifer's first grade class and still remembers her really long, unkempt hair and hand-me-down dresses. "She struck me as being really poor," he said, "and I remember being weirded out by her. I really just avoided her for the most part. She was more of an outcast." Man, it's a shame that and I'm pretty sure all privileged kids do this at some point in their lives, mainly in elementary school, I would assume. Like, all privileged kids don't really grasp the concept of, like, you know, some kids don't have what you have. My girlfriend was just telling me a story about when she was a kid, she used to volunteer at a homeless shelter, and she was like 7 years old and would hang out with some of the homeless kids that were there, and because her family would volunteer and she would, you know, be with the other homeless kids and would be like, "Oh, it's so cool. You get to sleep in bunk beds and get to have sleepovers all the time." And I'm sure the kids were like, "Yeah, we don't have any other choice." You know, it's a very eye-opening moment when it comes to privilege. Like, "She struck me as being really poor, and I remember being weirded out by her." The weird poor girl. It's, which now we know as adults, it's not their fault, but children have not developed empathy at that stage, which is why we need to do our best to teach them now, I think. I do think that the world is becoming a better place with how we're instilling lessons into future generations, because that's the beauty of social media as well, with the ability we have to look up stories, with the wealth of information that we have, just with the internet in general, we can look at case studies of what not to do. And people can give their stories. You can read a Reddit AMA of people who give their stories as, like, here's what not to do, here's what to do. you know, David and Louise Turpin, you should not abuse your children. You know, I can absolutely see where Jennifer is kind of, she kind of has to scrape to survive in elementary school, but, you know, you can't put it past elementary schoolers to not know how to be real people yet. On December 17th, 1995, Louise Turpin gave birth to her fourth child, Jonathan Wayne, at Texas Health Harris Methodist Hospital, Southwest Fort Worth. John Wayne, she named her kid. Isn't that interesting? He was a healthy baby, weighing 8 pounds 8 ounces, and was 20 and a half inches tall. His proud parents sent a photograph of baby Jonathan to the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, which subsequently appeared in the birth announcements column. He joins his older siblings, it read, Jennifer 7, Joshua 3, and Jessica 2. It seems like Louise, especially, David and Louise like showing off, they like keeping up appearances, but I didn't realize to what extent. I didn't realize they were putting their kids in the paper and this, that, and the other. You would think that it would be kind of difficult to do that while also abusing your kids. And it doesn't even seem like they're abusing them yet, but also the dirty little Turpin girl, I mean, there does seem to be some neglect going on there. She's greasy, she's dirty, and she's very, very excited to play. She's excited to have the opportunity to get out. Even when she gets into school, she's excited to socialize. You can tell she's being a little bit neglected. But it's not like chain your children to the furniture neglected yet. We haven't got there yet. We're going to get there, unfortunately, but we haven't got there yet. In June 1996, Louise and David brought their four children back to Princeton for a family visit. They proudly showed them off, assuring close family members there would be many more to come. The children were all dressed in identical clothes, right down to their shoes. They would all walk in a straight line, recalled Teresa. They would act like a school rather than a family. I just thought she was overly strict with them. Once again, David and Louise paid for everything, taking everyone out for lavish meals at different restaurants every night. And both their families were duly impressed by the luxurious lifestyle David and Louise and the kids seemed to enjoy. It was that Louise had really found her prince charming and was living the American dream. During their visit, Elizabeth, who was now studying at Lee University in Cleveland, Tennessee, asked if she could spend the summer with them in Fort Worth. David and Louise readily agreed, and when they left to return home, Elizabeth sat in the back of the van with the children. As they drove through Louisiana, David suddenly took an exit off the interstate. Louise announced they were going to a casino to gamble, asking Elizabeth to look after the children while they were away. But first, she made her sister promise never to tell anyone in the family they gambled, as it was against their religious beliefs. I was in shock, remembered Elizabeth. We were all raised up in a strict Christian home and taught that gambling was a sin. A few hours later, as the children slept in the back of the van in the casino garage, David returned. He seemed very upset, complaining that Louise had a serious gambling problem and refused to stop even though she was losing heavily. Then he went back into the casino, saying he hoped they would have enough gas money to reach Fort Worth. Several more hours passed before David brought Louise back to the car. They had obviously been arguing. Louise was upset, said Elizabeth, and yelled, "I'm not a child. Stop bossing me around." Former Princeton High School teacher Pamela Winfrey would often think back to the day she had unwittingly excused Louise Robinette from class so she could elope with David Turpin. She regularly shopped at the Walmart in Bluefield, where Phyllis Robinette now worked as a cashier. "One time I mentioned to Phyllis that I had taught Louise on the day she'd left," said Winfrey, "and asked her about it. She said it was because of Louise's dad that she got married. I told Phyllis I was amazed how brave and gutsy she was to run off. I would never have the nerve to do anything like that." When Elizabeth moved into 3225 Roddy Drive, she was initially delighted to be reunited with Louise. They enjoyed spending time together, playing board games, listening to music, and watching movies. But Elizabeth would soon realize just how strict Louise and David were with their young children, especially Jennifer. They had to ask permission to go to the bathroom, said Elizabeth. They had to ask permission to eat. Elizabeth never saw her sister or brother-in-law display any affection or tenderness toward their children. During the summer Elizabeth lived there, she never once saw them kiss their children or even hold them. They never read them a book, tucked them into bed, or gently rocked baby Jonathan to sleep. Elizabeth was also puzzled by Louise's almost ritualistic mealtimes. After placing the plates of food down on the table, she would call the children down to eat one at a time. And for some reason, Louise was always harsher on Jennifer than any of the others. Before being allowed to eat, the first grader had to look her mother in the eye and smile, and then wait for it to be returned. And then Louise would say, "Okay, sit down." And then she would literally just sit there, said Elizabeth, waiting for permission to eat. And then Louise would tell her, "Okay, you can eat." After Jennifer had finished eating, her mother would tell her to stand up, look at her, and smile before sending her back to her bedroom. It was like a secret code, recalled Elizabeth, at every meal. Jennifer and her three siblings were confined to their rooms for long periods of time and were never allowed any contact with their aunt, unless Louise was present. "She didn't want me talking to the kids," said Elizabeth, "and they weren't allowed to talk to me without permission." Louise told Elizabeth it was to protect her children, as she didn't want her beliefs, quote, rubbing off on them. Although she felt uneasy about how David and Louise were treating their children, the 19-year-old never challenged them. Elizabeth also noticed how they both had bad tempers. Usually soft-spoken, David would fly into a rage at the least provocation. "David would usually get set off if Louise did something he didn't like and get really mad," said Elizabeth. "When I lived there, he didn't want us doing anything together without him. She knew not to do it because he would just flip." Years later, Jennifer Turpin would tell investigators that she had witnessed her father losing his temper and physically attacking her mother. Eventually, David promised to stop, but it is unknown whether or not he did. Of course he didn't. Of course he didn't. Of course he didn't stop. This guy is a terrible human being. He's not going to stop abusing. He's not going to stop doing the things that he likes to do. So even from first grade, at least when Jennifer was in first grade, this is when it's already bad. It's already bad. But it's going to get a whole lot worse as time goes on. And eventually they're just going to stop like letting their kids go to school altogether. So it's going to be interesting to see how the abuse deteriorates as they start having more and more children, because they've only had 4 children at this point. 4 children, and they've got 9 more to go. This is one of the scariest cases I've ever, like, just the thought of being one of those kids scares the shit out of me. Oh my God, this actually happened. These poor fucking children. I am glad that they are out, and I am glad that they are safe. I'm glad that all this is over. There's the solace in this. The fact that we are reading about this case, the fact that we're learning about it, means that it is over. It is over for those children. But it's not really over, because they're still going to be dealing with the effects of this for the rest of their lives. But at least they are safe. Hopefully. Hopefully safe as they can be. Oh my God. It's just one of those cases where you have to just sort of drink it in for a bit. I don't even know what to say at this point. and you have a 19-year-old aunt that comes to stay for a little bit for a summer, and she knows that things are wrong, but even she doesn't want to speak up, even as an adult, you know? Even though she's still a child, she's still close to 18, she still has a voice, but she feels like she can't use it because David and Louise are just that unflappable. It's not worth getting into the trouble of dealing with them. According to Rick Ross, not the one that you're thinking of, it's an expert on cults and the founder of the Cult Education Institute, it was in Fort Worth that David Turpin began molding his family into a twisted cult, using his warped version of Pentecostal teachings as a foundation. He viewed himself as a charismatic leader, with Louise as his second in command. Rick Ross, if you've never heard of Rick Ross, the cult expert, is a wonderful man. He is an expert on cults and cult behavior, and he does a lot of work to deprogram members of cults that have gotten out. He is a wonderful man that I feel like more people should know about because he's done quite a service in the world of getting people out of cults and getting them to stop thinking like they are in a cult, to deprogram them, because it takes a while after you're out to stop thinking the way that a cult has taught you. And so in this case, in the Turpin case, we actually have a little teeny tiny cult. Cults don't have to be gigantic. You can have a cult with a family of 13. You know, the Ant Hill Kids is another cult that I think of. There are only like 20, 30 members of that. But then you can have gigantic cults as well. You can have cults of personality. They don't always have to be murder cults as well. Cults of personality are cults in and of the same. In a way, the following that I have on TikTok, for me, is a little bit culty in a way. But it's the most wholesome. Like all social media is a little bit culty in a way. Politics is very culty. So you kind of have to pick your poison when it comes to cults. And this, in the Turpin case, is
poisonous. Very poisonous indeed.
Over the next few years, as their family expanded, David and Louise introduced a set of elaborate rules and punishments, conditioning the children into absolute obedience and dependency. The children were required to call them mother and father. Ugh. What we call, quote, cult brainwashing is actually a synthesis of coercive persuasion or thought reform, explained Ross. And they develop influence techniques either by trial and error, instinctively, or they read books and figure it out. Something that cults, it seems like a lot of cults, a lot of cult leaders, people that are predisposed to be cult leaders, some of them just have the instinct to do cult leader behavior. Like they'll get a group of people together and then they'll just start working them to the bone and starving them just by instinct, withholding food, giving them menial jobs to do to keep them busy, just because that's what you do when you're in a cult. They'll rename them. A lot of times renaming is a facet of cults. Like they'll give you a new name, a new identity, so you feel more at home in the family that they have created rather than the family that you have already established for yourself, the life that you have already established for yourself. So the fact that they're like, call us mother and father now, that's another thing. If you are in an organization and the leader of the organization like comes out and says, hey, hi, just a real quick update. You guys all have to call me Guru now, or you guys all have to call me Vanguard, or you guys all have to call me Father or Papa or Moses or something. If they rename themselves, like, hey, I want you guys to start calling me Mother God now. Like all of the examples that I just listed were actual cult leaders that have renamed themselves to make themselves appear more mysterious, to give themselves some respect, to give themselves authority. I don't know why, but it seems as if by instinct they do it. Ross said family cults were all about power, control, and domination. The father figure simply wants to turn his family into essentially a group of devotees, said Ross. And there is no legitimate reason to leave. You don't grow up and move out. He said there was nothing new about family cults like the Turpin family. Who knows how many there are around the United States, he said. This is not uncommon, but we only find out about it when something horrible happens.
That's something to think about. Thanks, Rick. Jesus Christ. Oh my God. But he's right.
How many other cases are there like this? How many other cases are similar to this? How many cases are there where a mother and a father are keeping their three kids holed up in the house, homeschooled and sheltered and subservient? How many of those people are your neighbors? How many of those people have you lived near? Were they in your neighborhood? Did they live on your street? You don't know until after it happens. Even worse, what if a family member of yours is a victim in that situation? Or a perpetrator? You never know. It could be, though. I'm just saying, you should all think about that really hard and long before you go to sleep. Soon after moving to Fort Worth, Elizabeth found a summer job at a local store. Louise insisted on driving her to and from work, laying down a strict set of rules for her to follow. She was not allowed to have any friends, use their home phone, or even tell anyone where she lived. It was if she had now been recruited into the family cult. Louise was a very private person, explained Elizabeth. I was told that if I broke the rules, I would be kicked out. That summer, Elizabeth observed David and Louise at close quarters, learning the strange dynamics of their relationship. Outwardly, her sister appeared to be in control and to make all the decisions as David quietly watched with his arms folded. But then Louise would always look at him for affirmation. They'd make eye contact, said Elizabeth, and she'd say, "Right, David?" And David would either say, "Right," or he'd say, "Well..." Elizabeth said it was Louise who would decide whether or not to punish the children for some infringement of her growing set of rules. Then David would carry it out.
Oh, it's like Shelley and Dave.
Oh, Shelley Notech and David Notech. That's episode 2 of my podcast. If you have not read it, if you have not heard of the Notech case, that's another similar power dynamic where mom is calling the shots and she uses her husband as the muscle. But in the Turpin case, it seems like David is a much, 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 much more willing participant than Dave Notech was. Elizabeth was also becoming uncomfortable with her brother-in-law's increasingly inappropriate behavior. He began teasing her about an ex-boyfriend, saying that he must have gotten excited when she went swimming in a skimpy bikini. Ugh. One day in the kitchen, David and Louise opened up about their relationship. David admitting having had the hots for her sister since Louise was 10 years old when he had made, quote, a pass at her. Imagine one of your relatives telling you this, like, about their wife. Like, hey, I've been keen on her since she was 10 years old. And then you look, and then you have that moment where your eyes get real wide and you go, The fuck? Soon after this revelation, Elizabeth was taking a shower when Louise picked the bathroom lock with a coat hanger. Then she and David came in to watch. That was real inappropriate, said Elizabeth, and made me feel very uncomfortable. They would come in and watch me shower and make me get out in front of him. Ugh. As she self-consciously dried herself off, they began laughing at her in him in embarrassment. What the fuck is this? This disturbs me greatly. This disturbs me greatly because I hate my body. And just the thought of that, like my parents coming in, making me like dry off in front of them and then laughing at me like, ha ha, you're ugly. Oh my God. I was red from head to toe, said Elizabeth. They tried to pretend it was a joke, like they weren't doing anything wrong. From then on, David and Louise often watched Elizabeth in the shower, telling her she was beautiful. Although Elizabeth hated it, she had no alternative. She insists that David, though, never laid a finger on her. It still does not make it okay. If any of this sounds similar to anything that you guys are going through, go and call a crisis center. Go call a friend or someone that you trust to help you just hear you out. Because that is not okay. That's not okay. That's not okay. That is not okay. Former psychiatrist Dr. Michael Stone, a professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University, explained that incest victims often have no sexual boundaries. They tend to have various sexual abnormalities, said Dr. Stone. They were raised by people who violated rules, so there's no rules. Some of them become wildly promiscuous, and others feel that sex is dirty and disgusting after what happened to them. But there is usually some abnormality. Toward the end of the summer, Louise discovered her sister had befriended a fellow worker and regularly ate lunch with him. She was furious. After dropping Elizabeth off at work one day, she never returned to pick her up. Elizabeth was frantic and kept calling Louise, who refused to answer the phone. She spent the night sleeping on a bench at a nearby Walmart. For the next 3 nights, Elizabeth slept outside, going to work in the same clothes. Finally, Louise answered the phone, telling her sister to go home to Tennessee. It was only after Elizabeth threatened to call the police that Louise allowed her to come back and collect her things. So because she made a friend, don't come home, sleep outside. That's very alarming. That's incredibly alarming because it suggests that Louise, because normally, I mean, even in abusive relationships, like I'm thinking about like abusive boyfriend, girlfriend, like they might be very hypercritical of friends. They might be very angry. They might be, I don't know. There are a lot of abusive relationships that, you know, restrict friendships, that are very critical of friendships that the other partner may have. I can't speak for anybody or any abusive relationship. And I can't give like a, this is what all abusive relationships are like, because there is no, you know, prototype for an abusive relationship. But it's normally abusive relationships are not that extreme. Like you can't even talk to someone or else I'm kicking you out of the house. Like, it does not go that far because it's hard to keep that up. It's hard to keep that up. It's hard to control somebody like that when they are an adult, when they are capable. When they're a child, however, oh, it's incredibly easy. It's incredibly easy to keep a stranglehold on a child like that, especially when they're your child. She made a friend. And that was enough, because you can't have, what I assume is you can't have friends outside the family. You can't have anyone outside the family. We are your friends. We are your family. We love you. You're not allowed to love anybody else. And again, if this sounds similar to anything that you are going through, if you are in a relationship right now and your partner makes you feel that way, get out of there. Get out of there. And I know it's easier said than done than get out of there. But at the very least, call someone that you trust, text someone that you trust, call a crisis line. Do something. Do something. Please. For your own safety. You know, provided that you're safe. Provided that you're safe. Because sometimes, you know, you have to time it just right. So I just want everybody to be safe. Oh, God, this is rough. This is her own sister. On May 21st, 1997, Louise, oh, my God, was back at Texas Health Harris Methodist Hospital, Southwest Fort Worth, giving birth to their fifth child, a baby girl they named Joy Donna. The bouncing baby girl weighed 7 pounds, 7 ounces, and was 20 and a half inches tall. Again, The Fort Worth Star-Telegram printed her photo in a birth announcements column. 3 months later, Jennifer had started second grade at Meadow Creek Elementary School. Her hygiene had deteriorated even further. She smelled just like dirty clothes and urine, recalled classmate Jessica Bermejo. She always wore the same clothing, so she probably just never took it off, I guess. But her Aunt Teresa, who had recently visited, vividly remembered seeing a row of expensive dresses in Jennifer's closet that had never been worn. They didn't even fit her anymore, said Teresa. The tags hadn't even been taken off. $200 and $300 dresses. While the expensive dresses gathered dust in her wardrobe, Jennifer wore the same dirty long-sleeved white shirt and purple pants each day. The 9-year-old, now confined to her bedroom for hours at a time, also seemed unnaturally hyperactive, constantly doodling and playing with her hair. She also began exhibiting disturbing behavior in front of her classmates. She would touch her private area, Bermejo said. I don't know if it was itching, but it could have well been because she was dirty as well. Jennifer also said things that made everyone uncomfortable. She was talking about things that could indicate sexual abuse, Bermejo reflected. Things that were inappropriate for that age. I just kind of brushed it off. Jared Dana remembers a teacher sending Jennifer to the principal's office for rubbing her pubic area, but apparently no action was ever taken to investigate if there was a problem at home, and the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services have no record of the Turpins.
What?
When Jennifer was in third grade, there was a lice outbreak at Meadow Creek Elementary School, and everyone blamed her. I was actually one of the kids that got lice, said Bermejo. It was a big deal that a lot of people got lice, too. The kids were calling her the cootie girl because everyone knew that her hygiene was bad. Taha Munchaibudin and his twin sister, Nuha, were also in third grade with Jennifer and observed how badly she was treated. She was often made fun of by the other third graders, wrote Munchaibudin on Facebook, because her clothes would sometimes look as though they had been dragged through mud, which she would also smell like on most days. One day, Jennifer was humiliated when a teacher ordered her to remove an old Hershey bar wrapper, which she was using as a scrunchie to tie up her long, dirty hair. I distinctly remember my entire third grade class scoffing at her, Munchaibudin wrote. But even though she endures so much ridicule, the good-natured girl was always friendly. She tried to socialize, said Bermejo, but people just didn't want to play with her and stayed away from her. I reached out to her a few times, but I was an introvert as well. On June 15th, 1998, Louise gave birth to her sixth child, Julianne Phyllis, at Texas Health Harris Methodist, the long-ass hospital name. Texas Health Harris Methodist Hospital, Southwest Fort Worth. This healthy baby weighed 8 pounds, 14 ounces, and was 21 inches tall. She is welcomed by her brothers and sisters, read her birth announcement in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram alongside a photograph. A month later, David, Louise, and their four oldest children drove east to Princeton for a family visit. It was an unhappy stay, and Louise made no secret of how much she hated Princeton. She went to see the family one last time, Elizabeth later told Dr. Oz during an interview on his popular television show. She had told me that she wasn't going back there. She wanted to let Mommy and Daddy see the grandkids. Teresa believes her oldest sister was traumatized by that final visit, as all her childhood nightmares flooded back. She was so hurt, explained Teresa. Being there made her sick, made her resentful. It would be the last time David and Louise ever set foot in West Virginia, and there would be no more all-expenses-paid annual visits for the Robinette family. As Christmas approached, the Turpins were in dire financial straits. Although David was earning good money working for Lockheed Martin, he and Louise regularly drove to Louisiana to gamble. Louisiana. And she was still losing badly. Since getting kicked out of the Turpin home, Elizabeth had dropped out of college and gotten married. She eventually reconnected with Louise, and they talked on the phone regularly. During the calls, her sister often spoke about her love of gambling and how David disapproved. She said she loved the rush gambling gave her and couldn't stop. If that sounds familiar to you, there are lines that can help you. There are gambling crisis lines that can help you. That is another beast. Gambling, that's a sad, sad addiction. In late December, Elizabeth called her sister's cell phone. Louise said she was out Christmas shopping and would call back. Several hours later, she did, boasting that she was maxing out all her credit cards to buy as much as she could before they were declined. At that moment, she told her sister, David was in the garage stacking up all the children's presents. She then proudly announced that they were about to file for Chapter 7 bankruptcy. The bank was foreclosing on the Roddy Drive house, as they had fallen so far behind in mortgage payments. When Elizabeth questioned whether bailiffs would seize all their possessions after they filed for bankruptcy, Louise laughed. She explained that, although they would lose their house, they could keep everything else they bought on credit. Under Chapter 7 rules, they would even be able to keep their cars if they started paying off what they owed. Louise assured her shocked sister that all their debts would be written off, so they wouldn't have to pay for everything. Anything. When Elizabeth called this dishonest, Louise argued that they were only doing it so their children could have as many clothes and toys as possible in the future. It was only good sense, she said, to exploit the system before filing for bankruptcy. When Elizabeth replied that it sounded more like stealing, Louise slammed down the phone. In spring 1999, the bank foreclosed on the Roddy Drive house and evicted David, Louise, and their six children. Without any explanation, Jennifer stopped coming to Meadow Creek Elementary. She would never return to public school. None of the other Turpin children would ever see the inside of a classroom, as their father had decided to homeschool them. This would avoid any probing questions from teachers and parents about the Turpin family's unusual lifestyle. Louise, who had dropped out of high school at 16 to marry David, would be their teacher. Cult expert Rick Ross believed that the next stage of cult came when David and Louise withdrew their children from the outside world, setting up an alternative caricature of one within their own increasingly unstable home. Quote, he used those techniques to manipulate their minds and create unreasonable fears about the outside world, said Ross, and instill the kind of dependence, obedience, and submission that he wanted. Ross said that although David Turpin was clearly the instigator and leader of the cult, Louise willingly went along with it. This is an example of a group that is dominated by a patriarchal figure, said Ross, and the mother has some responsibility as well. But David Turpin was like a god in this family. He became an object of worship, and to disobey him was the cardinal sin. And the children had no life other than what he allowed them to have. Okay, that's interesting. Because I was led to believe earlier that Louise was kind of in charge, but it seems that maybe Louise is the mouthpiece, that she does a lot of the talking, but always is looking over her shoulder to see what David wants, it's always under the direction of David, or not even the direction, but under the fear of retaliation from David. Like there's a heaviness to the air, and she's like, I'm going to abuse you kids, right? And turns over and goes, right? David? After the Turpins moved out, the new owners of 3225 Roddy Drive were so appalled at the deplorable state the house had been left in that they took photographs. There was a terrible stench, and all of the floors and carpets were caked in grime. There were also large dark stains covering the walls of every room, which appeared to be feces. And that is where I'm going to leave us today. I'm going to leave us on the shit wall. Ugh. This is getting worse and worse. I feel like we're going to start to see an unraveling of David and Louise Turpin. More so than they already have. Like you're pulling a string out of a sweater and the sweater is disappearing as you keep pulling the string. They are unraveling. And their kids are going to pay the price for it. I hate these bastards. I hate them. I hate them. They are disgusting, deplorable people. And it makes me grateful that I had good parents. Makes me grateful that I had good parents. That I had parents that did not do any of this type of stuff to me. Thanks, Mom and Dad. Thanks, Mom and Dad. Thanks, Mom and Dad, for do that for me. You are the best. All right, well, that'll do it for today's episode of the Monday Night Book Club. If you're still here, if you're still with us, thank you for listening. Thank you for sticking around. I am glad that you are here. I'm glad that you're alive. I'm glad that you're safe. I'm glad that you're healthy. I'm just glad. I'm glad for you. So, from all of us here at A Slice of Ham, I want to take a moment and say, if nobody told you that they loved you today, remember that I do. Remember that I'm proud of you. And don't forget, no one can eat 50 eggs. No one can eat 50 eggs, no matter how hard you try. So don't try. Don't hurt yourself. It'll be okay. From all of us here at A Slice of Ham, we'd like to wish you a happy Arbor Day. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to vote. Have fun.